I think the orchestra are very keen that there are further opportunities to tour and welcome him back as soon as possible to their home in Salford and their regular concert season at the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester. I'm feeling the audience would like another encore. I'm not sure they're going to get one. Well, it's 8:15, Radio 3 live at the Proms, as we are every night between now and early September. Two Proms tonight, the eagerly awaited Gospel Prom at 10:15, including favourites like How Great Thou Art, Swing Low Sweet Chariot and Oh Happy Day. That'll be at 10:15, the London Adventist Chorale, London Community Gospel Choir and the People's Christian Fellowship Choir amongst the performers. Before that, we're going to hear Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, one of the subjects discussed in Proms Plus tonight, because we're going to cross the road for the next 20 minutes to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music, where members of the audience were given an introduction into this evening's programme. This edited version of tonight's Proms Plus is hosted by Louise Fryer.
Dr. Daniel Grimley of Oxford University will be joining us shortly to discuss the Fourth Symphony by Carl Nielsen. First, I'm delighted to welcome composer David Matthews, whose new piece, A Vision of the Sea, is receiving its world premiere. David, you were born in London, you still live in London, but you've had a couple of opportunities to live by the sea. Tell us about the importance of the sea to you and where you've experienced it.
Well, I've had a house in Deal in Kent since 1985. And it's become very important to me to be beside the sea. I mean, everyone has their experience of the sea here, and that's it's our national symbol, and everyone has a response to it. I think a very warm response to it, and often people retire by the sea. When I go there, I go there mostly to work, but I find the sea a great inspiration, not just for this particular piece, which is about the sea, but always. I mean, just to see the sea is the very good beginning of a day. I always go to see the sea before breakfast. I get my best ideas, I think, walking through various landscapes. And I think of my pieces often as initially as patterns of landscape. You know, I sometimes draw them out with the various climaxes as hills and so on, and plains and things. I'm going to get an idea of the form.
Well, that seems like a very good time. Thank you, David. We look forward to listening to your vision of the sea this evening. But it seems like a very good time to introduce Dr. Daniel Grimley. He's a man who knows all about connections between music and landscape. He teaches in the Faculty of Music at Oxford. And cultural geography, and in particular the music of Scandinavia, are his big things. One of his recent books is called Carl Nielsen and the Idea of Modernism. So he's also the perfect person to join me to discuss the work that ends tonight's prom, Nielsen's Fourth Symphony. I wonder if you'd just like to pick up on this concept of musical landscapes.
It's really interesting to think about Nielsen and landscape. It's a recurrent thread in his music and also in the reception of his work. And I think we have to go back to the very start of his life. He was born in a very modest working-class family out in the middle of the Danish countryside. And for people who haven't been to Denmark, it actually looks rather like the Kent or Suffolk coast. It's low-lying, often quite coastal. You have this strong sense of the interlocking patterns of sea and land. And he was part of a generation of artists and writers who were concerned with ways of talking about and aestheticizing the Danish landscape scenically. So towards the end of his life, Nielsen writes about the Danish landscape in rather idealistic terms. He talks about going to the island where he's born, Funen, and listening. And he says that Funen has a special sound, and that even the trees talk with a particular Funsk lilt, almost as though they have their own language. And I think what's interesting there is the way that he shifts from this idea of landscape as being mainly a visual phenomenon to something that's more sonic or inhabited or dwelt within. And I think that actually that experience of growing up in a landscape with a very close feeling for its texture and grain is something that was really formative on his development as a composer and a musician.
And do we hear that in this particular piece, in the Fourth Symphony?
Well, I'd like to think there are various points in the symphony where we can hear the landscape breaking through. There's a remarkable passage in the middle of the first movement where the music just seems to stop. You have a long pedal in the cellos and basses, and then a set of woodwinds in thirds playing this, almost a stylized bird call over that. And you feel that at that moment that the landscape is kind of breathing around you. But there are other moments when you feel as though you're caught up in some kind of geological process, as though the landscape's being formed and shaped by unseen forces that you cannot quite contain, but you can feel their impact upon you. And that's a much more dynamic sense of being out in the landscape, I think, rather than just standing there and looking at it or listening to it.
He wrote this piece in 1914, which was a rather difficult time for celebrating your country.
That's right. Well, this is, in one sense, a war symphony. So this is a piece that draws on a lot of these images of conflict and violence and of things moving apart and the friction, the dissonance that creates. Denmark, of course, wasn't involved directly in the war. We have no evidence that Nielsen thought he was writing a piece in response to the war. But for an artist who was engaged with a European cultural scene as he was, it was impossible not to be moved in some sense by the political tumult that was happening around him. And I think this is a remarkable piece because in some ways it's a real vindication of the power of music to offer you some kind of resolution. And to have that sort of gesture at that moment of extreme crisis and bloodshed, I think, took a very particular kind of courage. It's a very brave, if contingent, vision.
It starts off fairly chaotic, doesn't it? Take us through the opening.
Let's just listen to the opening bars of this symphony, because it's a real barnstorming way to begin. Nielsen has such a great way with openings. No one begins a symphony quite like Carl Nielsen does. And I think this is interesting because symphonies are meant to start with some kind of bold, confident gesture that gives you a sense of stability, which then becomes a point of departure. But here you already find yourself in the middle of some kind of process so that you feel that you're actually caught up in the excitement of creating this world around you. You feel as though the forces are already in the air sweeping you along. And that's really, I think, an important clue to the work's title, which is one of the most difficult words in the English and indeed Danish languages, the inextinguishable. Well, in Danish, it's the uluslulia, which is quite a mouthful.
I'm glad you said that.
And it's a way of talking about, it literally means that which cannot be quenched or extinguished. And what Nielsen's trying to capture here is some sense of the creative shaping of the material, the excitement of generating this at first chaotic symphonic vision. It's a very dynamic sense of the world in motion around you.
It's very much a noun, isn't it? Not an adjective.
That's right. It's a doing word. It's about that process of bringing things into some kind of sense of coherence.
And where does he take us next?
Well, then we have almost the polar opposite. So you've had this explosive beginning with its distinctive timpani signal, a tritone, and we'll come back to that later in the symphony. But then we have this second subject group, which is the complete opposite. Let's just hear a quick snatch of that.
Thank you.
So you get that second subject twice. When you first hear it, it's a kind of lyrical idea on woodwind and then strings. And for me, that always suggests some kind of image of the Danish fields in late summer. There's a sort of golden light that just suffuses the orchestral texture. And then you get it transformed as this glowing apotheosis idea. And that's really the symphony's point of arrival. And it's part of a tonal process that's going on in this work as well. We hit A major for the first time. And A major for Nielsen is quite often associated with freedom, with a sense of expansiveness, of a feeling of liberation. And this is really one of the expressive focal points around which the symphony revolves.
Is that the kind of opening you would want, David? I mean, how do you approach beginning a symphony?
How do I approach beginning a symphony? Well, all my symphonies seem to begin in different ways. They usually don't begin in a state of turbulence like that, although it's an interesting idea since I'm thinking about another symphony at the moment. But they usually tend to begin, well, they have begun with a quite a simple and sometimes quite long idea, which is then gradually developed and gradually becomes more complex as it goes on. But I love this symphony. I think it's wonderful. And I love the way it achieves stability finally out of all this chaos. It's interesting that Sibelius was also writing his fifth symphony at the same time, wasn't he? And he achieves a similar kind of heroic conclusion, going through a great process of disturbance. And though there's much more in Nielsen than in Sibelius, I think.
But he gives us this kind of sense of hope, doesn't he, almost from the start?
That's right. I think this is what's remarkable about this symphony, is that it's so wide-ranging, and you feel that these are forces that cannot possibly be reconciled, and yet there is always a sense of the energy or the creative spirit behind the music. And I think for Nielsen, as long as that is there, then there is hope for the world. And that, again, is what the title is really meant to be pointing us toward.
And then he takes us somewhere different again for the second movement.
Yes, the second movement isn't really a scherzo, it's more an intermezzo, but it's an intermezzo that takes us to a completely different world, and it feels almost as though we've stepped back in time to the late 18th century of Mozart and Haydn. And Nielsen was a great admirer of Mozart, and we can imagine it almost as a sort of little scene from a comic opera or a classical symphony. It's a delicate little piece for woodwind and strings that's half minuet, half a little gavotte, and it's worlds away from the turbulence and the hope of the opening movement.
Let's have a listen to it. So where is he taking us with this?
It's a very interesting gesture. It's interesting to think about Nielsen in comparison with another contemporary symphonist like Gustav Mahler. When you have that kind of almost neoclassical gesture in Mahler, it always has a sense of distance, of being Irenized somehow. This is music you cannot quite hear straight. And I think Nielsen's very different to that. I think this music gives us a sense of groundedness or a sense of home. There's a sense of inner peace and quiet about it. So it's really there in order to amplify that sense of contrast that we've already experienced in aspects of the first movement. So it's really trying to express the whole world in a symphony.
And then where are we heading? I mean, it's all going to go horribly wrong, isn't it? You can't help thinking at this stage. It's all just a little bit too calm.
There's simply is in four movements, but they play without a break, so you barely have a moment to draw breath. But one of the useful ways of thinking about this piece is to imagine it in two halves, and the first half is that turbulent first movement and then the gentle Mozartian intermezzo. Then the second half begins with what's in fact a slow movement, the third movement, and this sets out to rebuild the symphony almost from scratch. So we begin with a very, very long melodic line on the strings that I think points to the influence of Sibelius on Nilsson's approach to orchestration. And this immediately suggests a sense that there are darker clouds on the horizon.
Captures something of Britain for me, that arresting
it does, doesn't it?
String sound.
Yes.
It's a remarkably expansive sound just from one very simple melodic idea.
Yes.
And then it forms the basis for actually almost 10 minutes of continuous melodic music. It's really the most remarkable example of composing out from a very, very simple initial idea and then just letting the melodic lines expand, almost like you're moving towards some kind of distant horizon. And then as we build this music, we get a more hymn-like chorale passage that's first on the strings and then on the brass, and it builds up to the most tremendous sense of climax. Let's just listen to that. This is part of the symphony's tonal journey again. This is a real breakthrough for the symphony's journey towards its concluding point. This is E major, which recaptures the end of the first movement. And if in the first movement A major had symbolized a certain kind of freedom or expansiveness, the addition of that extra sharp to the key signature, four sharps rather than just three, gives this music a much brighter, even more confident tone. And you get those triumphant sort of timpani triplets as you reach that key at that moment. But this is no conclusive victory at this point. We're far too early in the symphony for that. And there's much more terrifying drama to come.
Mostly provided by the timpani.
Yes, well, I told you to listen out for those timpani tritones at the very start of the work, and they've been shadowing it all the way through this piece. And then the finale begins with a sense of confidence, as though it's going to resolve everything in some kind of straightforward heroic gesture. But the timpani come back with those tritones, and Nilsson introduces a second set of timpani that he writes should be placed at the far edge of the orchestra near the audience. So they're meant to be right in your eyeline and earline. And they have a dramatic duel with the original first set of timpani that tries to disrupt the whole flow of the symphony. Let's just listen to their first entry. and then we're back into A major, and the symphony is almost done, but not quite, and I won't spoil the ending for you before you hear it tonight. And of course, I think it's tempting to go back to that idea of this being a war symphony and hear that timpani duel as in some way an attempt to capture the sound of the guns. But I think actually that's to misread what Nielsen is trying to do here, because he doesn't like program music to be that literal. He doesn't like the idea of program music at all. I think this is rather an attempt to try and distill the idea of the symphony as a drama of conflict and friction and dissonance, and to crystallize it in its most elemental and pure form, so that when you finally emerge out of that conflict, you have a real sense of the possibility of some kind of resolution.
And how was it received here in the UK? What did we think of Nielsen then and now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Nielsen is a composer whose star is still rising. And this symphony was first played in London in 1923, but it's only recently entered the repertoire. So I think he's a composer whose time has yet to come. But I am struck by some of the similarities I hear between what Nielsen's trying to do in this symphony and also in his fifth, with aspects of what Vaughan Williams was doing in his later symphonies, and also what Tippett was doing in a work like the Second Symphony. Mm. That idea of the symphony as an ethical process or journey is one that I think has appealed to a whole generation of later British symphonists.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I grew up with Nielsen, certainly the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Symphonies, which I got to know as a teenager. And at the same time, I was also very, very impressed by Sibelius' symphonies. And they've really helped me, I think, become a symphonist, in the sense that they renewed the symphony at a time when a lot of people were saying that it was finished. Some people said that, you know, Mahler was the end of the symphony. Well, it's just not so. And I think there's tremendous vitality in Nielsen's symphonies. And I'm a great admirer of the way he's able to use tonality in a fresh way, again, at a time when a lot of people said that it was dying.
David Matthews and Dan Grimley, thank you.
Thank you.
Louise Fryer introduced that edited version of tonight's Proms Plus, which took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was produced by Helen Garrison. Well, this is Petrov Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where we're about to hear Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable. You heard Daniel Grimley talking about it there. In his programme note, David Fanning calls it a classic midlife crisis piece. As Nielsen started writing it in 1914, his marriage was in trouble with the revelation of numerous infidelities. He just quit his job as assistant conductor at the Royal Opera in Copenhagen, so becoming a freelance musician for the first time in 20 years, and World War I had broken out. Though Denmark was neutral, Nielsen found himself questioning the Danish national feeling. Once something high and beautiful, it has now become a kind of spiritual syphilis, he proclaimed. And against this background, he wrote a work about the unstoppable energy of life. Everything that moves, that craves life, that can be called neither good nor evil, neither high nor low, neither great nor small, but simply that which is life. Well, Juanjo Mena, the BBC Phil's chief conductor, comes from the Basque region of Spain. What's his take on this most Nordic of works?
You know, I worked a lot in Norway. I felt a little what happened with this type of music, no? And I learned a lot with them. It's wonderful music, and in this case, the symphony played the powerful, the energy, the contrast, and the virtuosity at the same time. I think it's one of the best symphonies of Nielsen, yeah.
It's about life force, about energy, about the very sap that keeps us going, isn't it?
I don't know if it's also a relation with to try to think for us that we are close to the nature, and the nature is powerful at the same time. No? In this case, I think it's some in this way to demonstrate the capacity of 35 minutes or 40 minutes of music with all the time energy. Only the second movement is the moment that we can take another different type of sound, another type of chorus, but also the third movement is playing the dramatic tension, also so strong for the strings. And at the end, after all of this, we have these two timpanis, and it's something really strange, no? But that this worked very well in this symphony.
Juanjo Mena, and here he comes, onto the platform of the Royal Albert Hall to conclude this first prom this Tuesday night, conducting the BBC Philharmonic in Nielsen's Symphony No. 4, Inextinguishable.
Thank you. Thank you.
With the title The Inextinguishable, the composer has sought to express in one word what only music has the power to express in full. The elemental will of life. Music is life, and like it, inextinguishable. For those words, Carl Nielsen put as a short preface to the score of his symphony performed here at the Proms by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Juanjo Mena. Richard Davis, principal flute. John Bradbury, principal clarinet, taking bows. The woodwind section standing now. Principal horn, Andrew Budden, and his colleagues. And principal trumpet, Jamie Proffitt. Principal cellist, Peter Dixon. Leader of the bass section, Neil Talton. And Yuri Tuchinski, leader of the orchestra. And I knew there'd be a big cheer for principal percussionist Paul Turner and principal timpanist Paul Turner and fellow timpanist Geraint Daniel. Such a vital role those two timpanists play in this symphony. Premiered here at the Proms, 1965, that was the first Proms performance with Barbaroli and the Halle. I don't know if we mentioned that word in context of the BBC Phil. Then it was only the third piece of his ever to be played at the Proms. 10 performances of the fourth alone have followed, showing the increasing popularity of Carl Nielsen as a composer. Well, the BBC Phil back here again with Juanjo Mena a week on Thursday, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, and wonderfully colourful Spanish programme to accompany that. But that brings us to the end of our live broadcast of the first of tonight's Proms, with Juanjo Mena back on the platform. What a great evening it's been. If you missed Rachmaninoff 2 from Nobuyuki Tsuji earlier on, do catch it on the iPlayer, or you can see it on BBC 4 television on Friday night. For now, though, from the Royal Albert Hall, good night, back to Broadcasting House, and John Shea is there.
Thank you very much to the inextinguishable Petroc Trelawney. As Petroc said, you can hear tonight's Prom again on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3, or again via the iPlayer for the via the iPlayer for the next 7 days. And you can also see not just the Battle of the Timpanists in the Nielsen Symphony, but also that remarkable performance of Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto by Nobuyuki Tsuji. That's on Friday evening when BBC 4 will be showing part of tonight's Prom, beginning at 7:30. Well, that's just one of two visits to the Royal Albert Hall tonight. We'll be back there at 10:15.
The first late night at the 2013 BBC Proms, and a celebration of gospel music's powerful songs of praise and passion. An emotive and richly varied musical world, the meeting of musical styles of four continents, from favourites such as How Great Thou Art, Swing Low Sweet Chariot, and Oh Happy Day. Join us as we explore the world of gospel music. The BBC Proms, tonight at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, before that, our next programme this evening, in a little over 10 minutes' time, is another chance to hear one of our features. First broadcast last year, a portrait of the playwright Sir Arnold Wesker. Matthew Sweet presents Wesker at 80 at 9:30. Then we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for that late-night gospel concert at 10:15. And Max Reinhardt is here a little later than usual at 11:45 tonight with the first of this week's Late Junctions. So, before our feature at 9:30, let's have a further encore from tonight's pianist Nobuyuki Tsuji. This is Chopin, the Berceuse in D-flat.
Thank you.
Chopin's Berceuse in D-flat, Opus 57, played there by Nobuyuki Tsuji. And let me remind you that you can see his performance of Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto from tonight's First Prom with the BBC Philharmonic on BBC Four on Friday evening from 7:30. If you can't see it on television, then you can also listen to it online via the Radio 3 website for the next 7 days. Well, let's have a little more from Carl Nielsen now, from very early in his composing life, long before the Inextinguishable Symphony. In fact, this is Nielsen's Opus 2, written in his early 20s, that's to say the late 1880s, when he was a violinist in the Royal Danish Orchestra. Two fantasy pieces, originally for oboe and piano. Here they've been borrowed by a flautist, and not just any flautist, Sir James Galway, no less. The pianist here is Philip Moll. music by Carl Nielsen, originally for oboe and piano, his two fantasy pieces, Opus 2, borrowed there by a flautist. And as Sir James Galway, I think we can let him off. The pianist was Philip Moll.
At the BBC Proms and live on BBC Radio 3, Viva Verdi. The second in a pair of concerts from Sir Antonio Pappano and the orchestra of the Rome Academy of Santa Cecilia includes the four sacred pieces and from the Requiem, the dramatic Libera Me. Saturday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Well, we're back at the BBC Proms in 3/4 of an hour from now this evening here on BBC Radio 3 for a late-night gospel concert beginning at 10:15. Now, though, at just after 9:30, another chance to hear a programme first broadcast on Radio 3 last year to mark the 80th birthday of the playwright Arnold Wesker, the celebrated author of over 40 plays, including Chicken with Barley Soup, Roots, Shylock and The Kitchen. In Wesker at 80, Matthew Sweet talks to Arnold Wesker about his life and long career. The programme includes some strong language.
Arnold Wesker loves his friends and he fights his enemies, and he's been doing it for 8 decades. He was born with the sound of the Battle of Cable Street ringing in his ears. He's been to prison for his political beliefs. He once tried to build a theatre where drama was as free as the national health. He's an idealist, and he's unquestionably one of the great British dramatists of the post-war period. His early plays, Chicken Soup with Barley, Roots, and I'm Talking About Jerusalem, customarily called the Wesker Trilogy, are landmarks in the culture. And yet, some of his most important plays have barely been performed in the country of his birth. In this programme, to mark his 80th birthday, you'll hear about Wesker's triumphs and his reversals. We'll talk to his friends and his critics. We'll discover how tough and bitter his personal struggle has been. And with the help of documents that nobody was meant to see until the year 2040, we'll tell the strange tale of an actor's revolt, a traumatised director, political censorship and a legal fight that propelled Arnold Wesker into the wilderness for years. The life of Arnold Wesker is an exemplary 20th century life, and it began in the East End of London in 1932, a year of hunger marches, coalition government and British withdrawal from Iraq.
I was actually born in a house called Mother Levy's, which was a Jewish maternity home in Valence Road, Whitechapel. But very quickly we moved into Fashion Street. Very fashionable now. But there was a narrow street with basements and attics. We lived in the attic. I don't remember it as being poverty. I had no sense of growing up in a ghetto. But obviously it was. There was a conversation I had with my sister once who said, "Arnold, you've no idea how poor we really were. Mum had to sell some chairs in order to feed us one day." And of course there was no bath, so I was bathed in a tin bath, which I remember as being lovely, especially as there was my 5-year-old girlfriend around to sing to me while I was being bathed. And now, what was the song she used to sing? "They gave him a gun to play with. They gave him a gun to play with. La da 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 dee da dum.
They gave him a gun to play with when he was a little boy. They gave him a gun to play with. It was his favorite toy."
Do you remember anything about the political character of that neighbourhood where you grew up? Because this was an area which at that time had a very strong communist presence. That sort of ideology was very much in the air, wasn't it?
There was a special street corner where the Communist Party used to hold meetings. Most of the demonstrations took place outside the East End. We would take the bus or the underground to Hyde Park Corner or Trafalgar Square. And I remember demonstrations taking place there. I know I wrote a play called Chicken Soup with Barley that begins with the anti-Mosley demonstrations, but I was only 4 years old at the time. But the reason I could write about it as I did with authority was that it was material that my parents repeated, and people came into the house in Fashion Street and talked about it nostalgically. But I don't have a memory of demonstrations in the East End myself.
Do you think that communism, in a way, was a new kind of faith for secular Jews in that period?
Very much so, and certainly very much so for my mother, who could never really relinquish it, and her brother, Uncle Harry, both staunch party members, and didn't believe the revelations.
That came in the 50s?
Yeah. I don't want to feel treacherous about my mother, whom I adored, but she was very simple in her beliefs, in her faith in communism. But it certainly was held as other people held their religion.
The destruction of that faith, or the undermining of that faith, is one of the subjects of Chicken Soup with Barley.
Yeah, I mean, I describe Chicken Soup with Barley as the disintegration of a family set against the background of a disintegration of an ideology, which is, I suppose, what appealed to me. There was a poetic parallel between the two, family disintegration and the political disintegration. God, it's almost a long time ago.
The way that crisis of faith is portrayed in Chicken Soup with Barley, though, suggests that there was something heroic about sticking to that faith.
Well, that's because I'm full of admiration for people who survive the mistakes they make. And there was something about what happened in Hungary and was happening in the Soviet Union that I suspect my mother did think was probably true. But it didn't destroy her faith in simple socialism. And that holding on, that hanging on, I thought was heroic.
You think it doesn't hurt me? The news about Hungary. You think I know what happened and what didn't happen? Do any of us know? Who do I know who to trust now? God, who are our friends now? But all my life, I fought. With your father and the rotten system that couldn't help him. All my life, I worked with a party that meant glory and freedom and brotherhood. You want me to give it up now? You want me to move to Hendon and forget who I am?
She was upset that I portrayed the quarrels between her and my father. And I said, but Mum, look, the character in the play is a heroine, and you can't have heroines unless they're flawed. Whether she really understood that or not, I don't know. But she was mollified.
Did she ever see herself represented on stage?
She saw the play, yes. She was my first audience. I read it to her. I shall never forget, when I put the pen down on the last page, I was really excited, because after all the shit I'd been writing, this, I felt, was it. And I stopped her in her tracks. I said, Mum, you must listen to this. She was with a friend, a Mrs. Harris. Those were my two first audiences, and I read the play from first to last page. And she said, it's good. I'm not saying it's not good, but who's going to be interested in any of that? And she couldn't see that her life story and the family's life story could be of interest to anyone else.
There's something about the combination of deep, closely observed, sensitive, observational writing mixed with a bigger project in those plays, which I think is really appealing.
Dominic Cook, artistic director of the Royal Court Theatre, who, half a century after its first performance, brought Chicken Soup with Barley back to the court.
And I was so struck by how resonant and contemporary the play felt. I mean, obviously, it's very personal and rooted in a particular history. But that feeling of lost idealism is something that I really identified with, having been at university very politically active, and during the Thatcher years there was so much kind of, it seemed like it was a more politically motivated time than the time we live in now, and that decline, as it was mapped through the experience of Arnold and his parents, and his mother particularly, resonated very strongly.
It was the royal court that made Arnold Wesker a playwright. Until 1957, most of his professional experience had been in catering. Pastry was his medium. Then he went to the Streatham Hill Theatre to see John Osborne's Look Back in Anger in a touring version dispatched from the court. And he began to transform his experiences in the hot underworld of the professional cook into a drama called The Kitchen, a work that sank without trace into the mailbag of the Observer playwriting competition. So he returned to his desk and wrote the play that would become the first part of the Wesker trilogy. It was 1958, and a new wave was breaking from the Royal Court Theatre. Arnold Wesker was a young, working-class Jew from the East End of London with a talent unpolluted by university education. Surely they must have welcomed him with open arms.
Yeah, but they didn't. Lindsay Anderson read Chicken Soup with Barley and wrote me this extraordinary letter saying, "You really are a playwright, aren't you? Can I have your permission to show this to the Royal Court?" And he did, but they were uncertain about it, so they palmed it off to the Belgrade Theatre, which played for a week in Coventry and a week at the Royal Court. And because Dexter had made a success of it, they asked me, was I writing anything else? And I told them I was writing this play, which ended up being Roots, about this girl who had this boyfriend and he never turned up. And they said, can we take an option on it? £25. £25 option, yes, of course. But they didn't like it. Or rather, they had ideas for it. And I said no. And I thought that was the end of my theatre career. But fortunately, Dame Peggy Ashcroft read it and said this is ideal for Joan Plowright and persuaded her to do it. Joan read it and said she'd perform it anywhere. Dexter read it and said, I know exactly how to direct this. And it was done at Coventry again. I mean, again, a play was done at Coventry and then brought into the Royal Court.
So what was the Royal Court's attitude to you then? Did they not quite know how to handle you or to take you? Were you a bit too much the real thing for them?
I don't know. I really don't. Dexter told me afterwards, he said something like, you have no idea the way they talk about us, not being university educated, because he wasn't either. And I suppose I thought, well, I've written the plays. I mean, I've got the plays. The plays are my jewels. So it didn't worry me what they thought.
What did they think?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they thought I was too foreign, or rather not English enough. I don't know.
Michael Billington has been the theatre critic of The Guardian since 1971.
Apparently even The Kitchen, you know, which is now regarded as one of Wesker's classics, and I think is now his most performed work around the world, even that was given a sort of rather tentative Sunday night single one-off production at the Royal Court. And only when they saw that it was an absolutely amazing piece of theatre did it become absorbed into the repertory.
It's interesting that this should happen because theatre seems to have had a kind of disproportionately large input from the Jewish East End over these years. I mean, you know, you might think of Pinter or Kops or Berkoff even. What kept Wesker apart from that?
I suppose because there are degrees of explicit Jewishness in all those writers. I mean, Pinter, yes, of course, Pinter and Wesker have an extraordinarily similar background, both East Enders, both with fathers, in fact, who are garment workers. But whereas Pinter's Jewishness, I think, is absorbed into the texture of the plays, Wesker's is much more explicit. I think he would not for a moment deny that. That may be one thing that separates him from the others. And Wesker also, I think, has always been a fairly combative character and wants the plays done in a very specific way, the way he envisions them. I mean, for all those reasons, I think Wesker's had a tougher battle, as it were, to get acceptance.
But he's also been accepted by those who might have been considered his natural enemies. Terence Rattigan has gone down in history as the playwright against whom the angry young men of the Royal Court mobilised their fury. But in Wesker's case, at least, Rattigan did not return the contempt.
Dear Arnold Wesker, I think Chicken Soup and Barley is a fine and moving play. I hardly expected to find myself at both intervals of your play with tears staining the raddled and reactionary old cheeks. Press on to greater glory, and for God's sake, don't read your critics. Well, read them, but but don't pay too much attention to them, or you'll find yourself writing the plays they want you to write instead of the plays you want to write.
Wesker, please.